Welcome to our live Dig Deep political conversation. It is our membership drive. You Dig is the name of the membership drive, and this is Dig Deep. If you're listening on the radio, or maybe you're here in the studio with us, there's so many people here.
Yeah.
We dig that you're here. We dig that you care about issues that are being discussed tonight. I'm Heidi Holton. I'm the News and Public Affairs Director at KBXC. So the concept of Dig Deep is to have these thoughtful conversations about topics that pertain to our life in rural Minnesota, because we don't hear it in a lot of media. We feature Aaron Brown. He's our liberal commentator to my right. And
your left. Get it?
Yes. He's a journalist by trade. You know him from Minnesota Brown. He covers life on the Iron Range. And to my left is Chuck Marone, an engineer by trade, CEO, and founder of Strong Towns. He's our conservative. And thank you both for being here tonight for this live edition.
Thank you.
So we are in our membership drive, as I mentioned. It's the UDIG membership drive for this hour only. We offer this beautiful new t-shirt, You Dig, right here. It's only been for sustainers. Tonight you can get it for $10 a month or above. If you call in right now, 800-662-5799, or you grab a staff person, the huge crowd that is here tonight. The important thing is that you appreciate programming like this, where we give time for topics that matter to where
I like
live.
The color on that shirt, too. I mean, that red and gray is like really a nice combination. Mm-hmm. I don't know who came up with that, but that's perfect.
Sarah.
It's a little bit like iron ore-ish with a little bit of like
a little darker, little,
Minnesota spirit in it.
A little
it,
more
right?
Red.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it.
So at the end of the talk, the audience will have time to ask questions or comment to Aaron and Chuck. But what we're going to do tonight is take a look at this really dramatic year of Minnesota politics. We're going to look at the Minnesota governor's race as well as District 8, and we're going to find out a little bit more some of the issues that they might be talking about on their campaign trail, maybe what they should be talking about on their campaign trail. So let's begin with who is running first for Minnesota governor in 2018. Aaron, you want to kind of fill us in?
Drama.
Yeah, well, that's been the race that has taken the most twists and turns, I think, in recent weeks. Tim Walz, a congressman from southern Minnesota, is announced earlier on, and he did not get the endorsement, though the DFL endorsed Aaron Murphy, state representative from St. Paul. And then after the endorsing convention, due to a 5 or 6 part human drama that played out, Lori Swanson, attorney general, announced she would run for governor and filed on the very last day of filing. So those are what I would call the major candidates for governor on the DFL side. We do have a couple of last-minute lower-tier candidates, I guess you'd say. They're not super well-organized. Ole Savior, of course.
Running as a Democrat.
Running as a Democrat this time. He's run as a Republican, and he's running, I think, every election for a long time. And then Tim Holden is another candidate. But those three candidates, Walz, Murphy, and Swanson, are the major candidates for the DFL side. On the Republican side, of course, the party endorsed Jeff Johnson, Hennepin County Commissioner, who was the nominee 4 years ago when Governor Dayton was reelected. He won the endorsement, but of course the big name in the race is probably former Governor Tim Pawlenty. And so you have a very well-financed Tim Pawlenty against Jeff Johnson, who was the inside party activist choice. And that's shaping up to be an interesting race in its own right. There is a minor candidate, Matthew Cruz, who has also filed as a Republican. And we were waiting to see who cleared petitions to be third party candidates, because there are only two major parties in Minnesota now, DFL and Republican Party. So we did see today that Josh Welter cleared his petitions to be a Libertarian candidate for governor, and Chris Wright of the Grassroots Legalize Cannabis Party is also going to be on the ballot for governor.
All right. Here's the thing that I find interesting. Back when Dayton ran for the first time, he was also not the endorsed candidate of
Correct.
The DFL party. It was
Margaret Anderson Kelleher. Yeah.
Thank you. And she really was kind of dominating up until the very end, when Dayton kind of, I remember when the returns came in the primary, and she looked kind of positioned to win, actually, mm-hmm. until the range started to come in.
Yeah.
And Mark Dayton just dominated on the range in a way that turned that whole primary around.
It was the range, but it was a lot of rural Minnesota as well. And, you know, that was interesting, an interesting race because Anderson Kelleher got the endorsement, but everyone knew Dayton was coming, and Dayton was a former senator who was had enough financing to, you know, run his own ads and do his own thing. But and Dayton was leading in the polls, but Anderson Kelleher had closed in the last week or two of that election. And then as the early returns came in, like you mentioned, the city vote went pretty hard for Anderson Kelleher, but Dayton came from behind. Now that's one of the classic stories of Minnesota politics is really it's just a function of the fact that the range counts their votes slower. There's no like magic.
It's the drama because it's of the how slow
it's not magic. It's not like we get to cast our spells from here in northern Minnesota to change the outcome of elections. It's just that we're slower slow. Yeah. in counting the votes. But that effect made it look like this dramatic comeback, and Dayton. It was a fairly close election, but Dayton did pull it off, and then pulled off a very close race against Tom Emmer in the general election that year.
It feels like on the DFL side this year, you have a very clear, again, urban candidate. You know, Aaron Murphy got got the endorsement, mm-hmm. and you know clearly got it on the kind of backs of the very strong urban support that she had. I think Tim Walz is the, you know, his appeal has been more of a, if we want to call it a moderate, or more of a kind of broader coalition. I think people believe he would appeal more to outstate Minnesota, and I think that's probably the case. I wonder how Lori Swanson entering the race affects that dynamic.
I think it changes it a lot.
I think it changes it a lot, too.
Because before we knew Lori Swanson was going to run for governor, it was looking like a Walz-Murphy primary. And it was looking like that would be a pretty close race, maybe even one that I would say favored Walz. I think a few podcasts ago, I predicted Walz might win that primary.
It kind of felt like a rerun for me of mm-hmm. Kelleher-Dayton.
Yeah.
With Walz being maybe even a little bit stronger than what Dayton was back then.
Right, because Walz, I think, had built a lot of support in places like the range. Not that, again, they just count the votes slower. It's not magic, but...
I'm going to say it's magic.
Yeah, oh, thanks. Yeah, yeah. Well, I just people ask me like, what's the mystique of the range on election night? And it's not a mystique. I've been there. I've been where they count the votes. But now with Swanson in the race, and particularly with Rick Nolan,
with Rick
running,
Nolan as a running mate. Right.
I mean, Rick Nolan had said he was going to retire. I mean, this was, I think, the big drama of that last day. Rick Nolan was going to retire. We already had, and we'll talk about it later, this complicated race to replace him in Congress. And Nolan was going to come home back to Crosby and take it easy, look after his family and garden and whatever he was going to do. Well, I think I've heard from people now who have talked to Rick Nolan at that state convention. He was not retiring at that convention. I think he knew something was coming.
And, oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, and sure enough, a day or two later, he's running as lieutenant governor on a ticket with Lori Swanson. Now, normally I say the lieutenant governor is a position where the only thing you can do is screw up. There's really absolutely nothing else you can do that other than screw up. And if you don't, then you're a really good one.
Right.
But putting Rick Nolan, who is kind of a marquee candidate, you know, he had considered running for governor himself.
The conversation was that he would be a good candidate for governor.
Right. And so putting him on the ticket, really, the job itself, there's not much to do other than inquire as to the health of the governor.
Even more, I mean, you joke, but it's
even more than vice president.
Even more than vice president.
You don't preside over the Senate.
Right.
You hold meetings. You and I'm not saying, if there's any lieutenant governors in the audience, I'd like you to know that I think you're all right.
Yeah.
But they can do a lot of things for advocacy, and they can be very, as Tina Smith, who was lieutenant governor, now U.S. Senate, was very involved in the administration in terms of, but that was a unique situation. She was the chief of staff and moved up to lieutenant governor. Anyway, my point is Rick Nolan being on that ticket dramatically shakes up the 8th and maybe the 7th district.
Right.
And a quarter of the state's districts. And 8th has a... I'd say one of the big dynamics to watch here is that the 8th district has a congressional primary on the DFL side. And now, due to the craziness of that last day of filing, so does the 5th Senate district, which means the Minneapolis area and Duluth and the Range and Brainerd now have what I would call a disproportionate effect. And it's not that the other districts won't vote, but that there's more reasons to vote in the 5th and the 8th district than there are statewide. So
they're more competitive races.
More competitive races. A very competitive DFL primary in both of those places.
Right.
So high turnout means in the 8th district means that, you know, normally I would have said that benefits Walls. But with Swanson splitting those votes probably with Walls and Murphy getting some of the votes, but I think that cuts into Walls. Now, Walls is going to do fine in the first, and the Walls folks like to tell you that they think they can compete elsewhere, too, that they're not going to get shut out in the cities, that they're going to get some votes there, too. They've got Peggy Flanagan, who's a pretty popular person running on their ticket, a well-liked person. She's proven to be a pretty adept campaigner. But she's never going to get as much attention as Rick Nolan's going to get in the 8th district. There's just no way. So I think Swanson really probably affects Walls more than Murphy and might give Murphy her best chance to win this primary in a way by breaking up that Dayton block that you mentioned and driving folks towards those two candidates.
That was my sense, too. And as we switch over to talking about the GOP here, which I think this impacts the GOP race, too, it feels to me like what we've done in the DFL is essentially created that a glide path for the very urban, very progressive, the most urban, most liberal candidate amongst the DFL has, I think, like a clear path now to getting the nomination. And that's different than it was 8 years ago. And I think that's going to impact the general election quite a degree.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the Republican side now? Because
You go ahead. I'm not... It's funny because when we got here tonight, someone said, well, you're the Republican. And I'm like, well, I really don't even identify as a Republican anymore because it's such a weird, crazy place. That being said, you know, I always value your take. So why don't we give you your... Go ahead and give your take on the Republicans, and then I'll...
You can tell me where I'm wrong.
I'll kind of augment that a little bit.
Well, we've got the... It's a little more straightforward. There's a one-on-one, essentially, between Tim Pawlenty, the well-financed... Everybody knows who Tim Pawlenty is, and Jeff Johnson. Fewer people know who he is, but he was a statewide candidate 4 years ago, and he's pretty well-known, certainly, among Republicans anyway. Normally, you'd say the money would favor Pawlenty, the name recognition would favor Pawlenty. This is my take. I think, particularly, again, going to rural Minnesota... And looking at, and there's a strong, now there's a strong Republican base in rural Minnesota. I can't help but think that this race could be close and that Jeff Johnson might not be favored, but I think he's got a chance against Pawlenty. Now, if he gets buried by tons and tons of spending and if he can't raise any money, he may get shut out just for that reason. But I don't think a lot of Republicans were hungry for a Tim Pawlenty comeback.
No, I'm gonna back that up.
Yeah,
I feel like this is a race of the endorsement and basically like the ground game of the party versus the financial clout of a former governor who has connections with Wall Street and DC lobbyists and what have you. And which one of those two would emerge really has less to do with issues and candidates. Although I will say, I think the former governor, I think Tim Pawlenty. Kind of augmented his position a little bit by picking Michelle Fischbach, which is a fascinating, you know, like you said, the lieutenant governor is not a real heavyweight kind of position. But if you're trying to signal to people like, hey, all those concerns you have about me being like captured by Wall Street and captured by lobbyists in D.C., I'm back. And I just kind of hitched my trailer to, you know, this woman who's very, very conservative, outspoken conservative, almost, dare we say, you know, bordering on sometimes, and I'll say this amongst friends here, a little bit crazy at times she comes across in terms of, like, the singular focus she has on a few very ultra-conservative issues. By hitching his, you know, thing to her, he really signaled strongly that, like, look, I'm going to be deferential to the Tea Party wing of the party. I'm going to be deferential to the abortion wing of the party. I'm not going to rock that boat. I'm not going to, you know, touch that. So don't be worried about me in that way. I think it's one of those where, like, I don't feel comfortable calling it. I wouldn't say at this point either one really has a clear-cut advantage, but I think it's going to be a fascinating race. And if Pawlenty wins, he certainly is going to, I think, come across just because he was governor for 8 years. He's a known quantity. People are, you know, to whatever degree, maybe not hungry for him, but at least comfortable with him. And on a statewide basis, I can see him being a stronger candidate than Erin Murphy. Jeff Johnson, I think, makes the race a little more wide open because you're kind of learning about two candidates there. And while you may have misgivings as an outstate person about a very liberal urbanite, you also have, you know, the Hennepin County commissioner, and that doesn't like ring a bunch of happy thoughts either. So I think
he's from
more
the rural part
the
of
rural
Hennepin
part
County.
Of Hennepin County. But up here, when we think Hennepin County, we're not thinking that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know.
You're listening to our live Dig Deep. We're talking politics tonight. This is our membership drive. We'd love to have you join us to let us know that you dig conversations like this. Give us a call, 800-662-5799. Or if the giant audience wants to pledge, you can find one of the staff people here. But so let's talk, though, about some of the issues. Do you know what are differences between the DFL candidates, or how are they going to handle this as a campaign? So they're campaigning against the other Democrats, but they've also got to keep in mind what's going on the Republican side. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not easy.
No, and you know, I moderated a DFL debate here. It was getting to be a while ago. There were a lot more people at the table than there are now. And trying to identify the policy differences, and even Johnson and Pawlenty, I think it would be a similar challenge. The policy differences are marginal. You know, you might get different priorities. You might get shades of difference on an issue like non-ferrous mining. You might get shades of difference on health insurance and whether or not you're for single payer or whether you're for some kind of publicly delivered option, however you want to phrase it and talk about it, you might get shades of difference on those things. But I think the difference really comes down to, and this is really a product of modern politics, it comes down to perception and how the candidates are perceived, how they project themselves, and what kind of image that they cast. And I think each of them in their own way is starting to form, you know, like we were talking about Tim Walz. Walz was considered a more moderate, big tent kind of figure when he was in Congress. He won fairly reliably in a more conservative district. And then he picks Peggy Flanagan, an urban liberal, but with family ties to White Earth Reservation and Native American heritage and some greater Minnesota credentials there. And they campaign together all the time. So they're trying to send this message. Well, Erin Murphy picks Erin May Quaid, and she took some criticism because, as you point out, it's an all-urban ticket. But on the other hand, she is making a statement of sorts as well. She's picking one of the most vocal voices on two issues in the legislature, the Me Too movement and the gun issue, gun safety. You know, she did the sit-in in the state capitol. And so those are liberal issues, to be sure. But she's making a statement that those issues might be important. And for her to win, they need to be the issues that motivate people, particularly people to vote, because this will be a turnout election in both. Midterms are always turnout elections. Who turns out? Not everybody votes, so who's excited to vote? And Erin Murphy made the calculation, and she may be wrong, and maybe Tim Walz or Lori Swanson is right. Maybe the other way around. But the calculation there was that these issues were going to motivate people to vote. You know, that's so they're making their choices that way. That's the differentiation I see among these candidates. And I don't know about the Republican side. Pawlenty is his own. He has two terms in office that are his brand, you know. And if you liked what he did, then you're then you know what you're going to get.
I wish we could have a deep policy discussion around this election. I don't feel like we're going to get that.
I agree.
And it's very frustrating for me because like we got here tonight and we're talking about these races and we're trying to inject like serious, thoughtful policy discussion into what is really like a horse race. And it's just, I don't think it's going to be there. If Tim Pawlenty gets the nomination, the one thing that I'm going to ask him at our debates, because we're hosting
August 21st at the Rife Center, a rural debate. All the candidates will be there, and it'll be the three of us asking questions. So, yes.
One of the things I'm going to ask Tim Pawlenty about is the North Star commuter line. And I'll just give some perspective to this. When Tim Pawlenty was running for governor the first time, he was against the North Star commuter line. This is a heavy rail line that runs north from Target Field up to like a field in Big Lake somewhere, or south of Becker. And he was against it because it was a waste, it was big government, it was transit, da da da. He became governor, and I think in his first term, he was actually a pretty good governor. He approved North Star. He pushed it. He was a vocal supporter of it. He said, I have essentially changed my mind. I think this is good for the state. It's good for Minnesota. And he went forward with it. It is probably the worst transit project we've ever done as a state. And this comes from a guy who's generally pro-transit, thinks transit is not a horrible thing. It was one of the worst projects we've ever done. I think it's going to be fascinating to see how he either embraces or walks away from that, how he is painted with that, because the GOP is solidly 100% anti-transit today. Jeff Johnson is 100% anti-transit funding. How he is painted in that, I think, is going to be really interesting.
So why is it the worst transit?
Well, you want to get into that? So actual policy? Well, because it starts at somewhere and it goes to nowhere. It should have started in Target Field and gone to St. Cloud and then not spent money hooking up cornfields and parking, you know, the back of Target on the way until you actually had some, like, development there to justify it. So it was just they wasted money and got no ridership when they could have connected two important cities in Minnesota and had it done really well. I feel like the GOP primary is going to be, and it has to be, a referendum on Tim Pawlenty. And it will be Tim Pawlenty, the decisions he made as an early 2000s kind of moderate governor who shifted to a governor who wanted to be president. It will be a referendum on Tim Pawlenty and his kind of feeble run for the presidency. And then it will be a referendum on Tim Pawlenty, the lobbyist and bank lobbyist who came after that. And if he gets through the primary like that, I think he emerges into the general election as a strong candidate, but he's got to get through that part of the primary.
And I think that's why I give Jeff Johnson a chance, because he said he's going to push all those buttons. He's going to go after those issues. And I don't know that he's got the guns to win, but you know, one of the things I want to say and make it very clear is I don't know who's going to win. You know, I don't know who's going to win the primaries for sure, and I wouldn't want to bet my paycheck on it. And I definitely, I mean, I think we started the year thinking the Democrats would be favored for governor. I view it as close to a toss-up right now because of the strange mood in Minnesota. We talked about it in our last podcast, talking about how there have, despite the national trend and the low popularity of the president, we may want to talk about that, that in Minnesota, and particularly in rural Minnesota, he's not as unpopular. And that area has become more conservative, I think, in the last two or three cycles as part of natural demographic change and economic change, and there's various reasons why that might be true. And so as a result, I don't take anything for granted in this, but I do think that conventionally, if this were 2002, like the first time Pawlenty got elected, this primary in the GOP side would be no contest, Tim Pawlenty all the way. But right now in 2018, after the upheaval of 2016, I don't know where Republican voters are with Tim Pawlenty. They may calculate that he's the best chance to win, as you point out, and maybe that's true. And maybe that's enough.
Maybe that's enough. Right now, I feel like the DFL and Aaron Murphy's campaign is certainly relying on the anti-Trump vote to drive people to the poll. People are energized on the left. They want to get out and vote. And I think that's the basic assumption. That might be true in other states, But here in Minnesota, we're a high turnout state. I mean, the difference between a low turnout and a high turnout is really not that much. Mm-hmm. People tend to turn out to vote. What you're relying on then is younger people showing up to vote. And that's always been fickle. Ask Jesse Ventura. You know, you really have that election in 98 as the one that brought out new voters. Even Barack Obama in Minnesota didn't really do that. It was, you know, Minnesotans tend to show up. And so I think the strategy of saying, you know, we're going to get people who are disaffected with the whole Trump phenomenon to show up and kick these Republicans out of office, I feel like that's a long shot here in Minnesota as a narrative.
Well, I think those people will show up. The issue is there's no reason that the Republicans won't show up too.
I think so.
You know, I just don't think we're a state where people say, grumble, grumble, I'm going to stay home. That might be true more in other places. And maybe there's some truth of it. You know, I think part of 2016's, you know, Trump almost carried this state. And I think part of the reason was there were some Republicans who came out to vote who maybe were infrequent voters. And there might be some of that.
Right.
But as far as counting on it, I don't see it. And I also see what we've always talked about, which is, you know, the increasing divide in voter attitudes between the suburbs and Twin Cities and the rural Minnesota.
This, I feel like, is a good transition to the 8th, which I think is even more interesting. I think is way more interesting than the governor's race. If you look at this state, my earliest, like, memories of this state really revolve around Walter Mondale winning Minnesota and looking at that map of red going, what kind of weird people are we? Like, I didn't really grasp all the nuances of why he'd win his home state and all that, and I was a little kid. But the idea that we would go from being the one blue state in an entire country of red in 84 to being a place that was up in the air in a Trump-Clinton election last time is really kind of in an epoch-changing kind of crazy way. And I feel like the epicenter of that change is here on the Iron Range. It's this area that has really gone from reliably deep blue for historic reasons that make a lot of sense to now this purplish bordering on red. And I was thinking about this week as we were coming in here, and maybe we should talk about this a little bit because it's kind of a crazy thought. But back when Nixon adopted the Southern strategy, it was really a strategy of taking conservative Democrats who had voted, you know, since the Civil War Democrat, and appealing to them in a very different way and shifting them from D to R, which is historically like a really difficult shift. I feel like we are in that same kind of transition here where the, you know, you see the Democrat Farm Labor Party shifting a little bit out of alignment with this group here in the range. And are the Republicans going to make a really good play for them? I feel like the 8th district and the congressional seat here is kind of like a battleground for that right now today. And I feel like it's up in the air, but I think we will know a lot about the next generation of Minnesota in terms of national politics by what happens in the 8th this time around.
Yeah, and I don't think it's happening all at once. I mean, we've really, from 2010, when Jim Oberstar lost, mm-hmm. we can't overstate the importance of that race. And then the fact that it's been a high-spending, high-stakes battleground ever since, we're just watching a change that isn't complete yet. And I do think, though, that the dynamic in the 8th mirrors a lot of what you see in Minnesota as a whole, which is Duluth, and maybe the heart of Brainerd and some of the towns becoming even more blue, and then the rural areas and some of the small towns on the range for different reasons, and we'll go into some of that, maybe skew a little more red or at least more purple.
But even when Oberstar lost, I felt like Oberstar's loss was more of a like anti-establishment kind of loss as it was like, I'm switching my allegiances from DFL to Republican. Because then you had Rick Nolan come back. And, you know, Stuart Mills was a legitimate and difficult and strong candidate. And Rick Nolan just consistently beat him. And it really, I mean, it was close, but it really wasn't that close.
Only one of them was really close.
Yeah. now we have something that I think is pretty wide open, and I would even make the case favors the Republicans this time around. And I think that that has a lot more to do with the underlying sentiment of the district than not. Let's get into the candidates, because you've actually reported on this in a serious, substantive way.
Yeah,
and I'd like to hear your analysis.
Let's talk about the DFL for Congressional District 8.
Sure.
Because that is also dramatic and confusing.
And the primary, I think, is one of the steps in understanding this race is understanding who might win this primary. And it's another case where I don't know. But the candidates include really a spectrum of folks. You've got Michelle Lee, former TV news anchor from Duluth. She has staked out a position, I would say, on the left of the DFL spectrum, and she has been the most vocal in favor of environmental regulation and most skeptical, or maybe even you'd want to say outright opposed to the non-ferrous mining projects as they're proposed now in Hoyt Lakes and Ely on the Iron Range. Then you've got, on the other side of a DFL spectrum, State Representative Jason Metza from Virginia. I think he's in his fourth term as a state representative, and actually becomes the most experienced political figure in terms of elections in this process. Jason Metza is, of course, one of the most vocal pro-mining DFLers, to the point that he's signed on to a lot of Republican bills, including preemption and some very conservative bills surrounding stripping regulations out of state law. So you've got the two sides of that one debate represented, and then you have Joe Radinovich, a former state representative, one-term state representative from Crosby. And Joe Radinovich is known for winning a seat that people were surprised he could win, and then losing that seat after voting for the gay marriage law in Minnesota. And despite a great amount of money spent and a hard campaign fought, he was defeated in his reelection bid. Well, he's bopped around. He was Rick Nolan's campaign manager, and he's held different jobs around the district, and now he's running for Congress. Addition to that, Kirsten Kennedy. She's the mayor of North Branch, a progressive mayor in a fairly conservative town and a very conservative part of the district. And she is probably less known than those other candidates, but is represents a part of the district that often gets ignored. And then on the last day of filing, we get a fifth candidate, and that's Soren Sorensen. And what I've written about him is a lot of people who follow DFL politics, or especially those who go to liberal cause events, know Soren. And he's a well-liked guy, but he's a very liberal guy holds a very anti-mining positions and things like that. And so Sorensen becomes, I think, a strong option as a protest for DFL voters who are really just upset with the whole thing. I don't expect him to win the primary, but he's there to take some votes. And he actually lives in the tiny part of Bemidji that's in the 8th district, the little sliver of Bemidji that's in the 8th. The rest is in the 7th. So that's every corner of the district is represented by a candidate in this primary. It's a huge district, bigger than some states. And they also represent a pretty good representative spread of the ideology of the DFL
party. I feel like
party.
You got your pick of
you,
a good
you
candidate.
You got somewhere to go.
Right. Depending on your issue.
Depending
you
on your issue and what you like your candidates to be like, look like, act like, you got an option in this race. And you know, the only polling we have is done by one of the campaigns, and so I hesitate to read the numbers, but the main takeaway I got from that poll was that people still don't really know who they're going to vote for. The candidate ahead was only in the teens, you know.
It seems like, to me, you could win this seat in the primary with 27% of
the
vote.
Yeah, I really do believe that, you know, if you got a third of the vote, you might be sitting on a nice cache of votes enough to win.
Right.
And as far as who has the best chance of getting to that third, well, I could plausibly make a case for at least three of those candidates getting there, and maybe four. And then you have to wonder, you know, what on earth could happen. So this, you know, we talk about policy and I'll just say, maybe before we get into the policy side of it, there are two big factors in this race, and we haven't even talked about the Republican side, which is important because the Republicans could win this seat, and I think that's a distinct possibility despite trends in the national climate regarding Congress, because the candidate on the Republican side that everyone's paying attention to is Pete Stauber, St. Louis County Commissioner from Hermantown, retired Duluth police captain, a long career in law enforcement, and he's a hockey star, which is kind of a potent combination of 8th District biographical information. Just the ad of him wearing a uniform and a hockey uniform at, you know, just jump shot between cop, hockey player. That's just, you don't have to say anything. You just got to have that. So he's a very strong candidate. He does face some nominal primary opposition. Harry Welty, a former Duluth school board member, he's run for office many times, and he's running as an anti-Trump Republican. God bless him. I'm glad he is, but I don't think that's the ticket to winning the Republican nomination in this particular election, in this particular state or district. And then we have an independent candidate, and he cleared his petitions. They cleared, and he's filed. Ray Skip Sandman from the Fond du Lac reservation, and a guy who's run for office before, but who, when he ran as a Green against Rick Nolan and Stuart Mills, he pulled 4% of the vote. And I think he could maybe do even better this time, depending on who wins that DFL primary. Because if you have a strongly pro-mining candidate like Metsa, if Metsa gets through, I think Sandman's good for 5, you know, conservatively. And so that creates a very interesting dynamic. It's a thread the needle. The DFL gets all the attention because the DFL has the trickiest situation. If they put a candidate forward who is too far to the left or too strident about mining, they run the risk of sending conservative Democrats or pro-mining Democrats to the Republican. If they go too far to the mining side, they risk sending their more progressive or environmental voters to Sandman. They've got to find some Goldilocks solution to this to come out looking united and with an agenda that somehow appeals to, it's going to take 50%, probably 50% to win that race, and they have the most approved. Now, Rick Nolan did it when Sandman ran against him. One of his closest races. He pulled it out. But
there's more gravitas there.
This is tough because Nolan was the incumbent in that race, and that's not a case here. Most of these candidates are fairly unknown to the broader public in the 8th District, and if you, like, for instance, Kennedy might be well known around North Branch, Chisago County, but no one knows her up here. Everybody knows Jason Metsa in the city of Virginia, but that poll and other people will tell you he's not well known south of Duluth at all. So every candidate has that kind of challenge and has to find their way in this race. But, you know, Chuck, we were talking about how the horse race is boring, right? Everybody talks about the horse race.
It doesn't keep me up at night.
Right. And one of the things that has frustrated me about the 8th District race is how hard it is to have a substantial talk, even about the issue that everybody seems to want to talk about, which is mining and the environment, and how hard it is to get people to bore down on what they mean when they say things like we support mining or we're skeptical of these mining projects, and trying to understand, you know, as a human species, as a society, what is our future going to look like around the issue of mining and what are our priorities going to be? Because right now, and I've been writing about it my whole career, we are faced with this false choice between jobs and environment. And it's a never-ending trek of sadness and despair that crushes the dreams and hopes of everybody who touches it.
Right.
And that's especially if you're a Democrat.
That's putting a happy spin on it. Yeah.
Because there's no winning, because one side wants complete fealty and loyalty to the mines, and the other side wants to shut it down. Or at least that's the perception. Most people don't believe that. most people are actually pretty receptive to arguments on either side in terms of having a conversation about it. But in political terms, in terms of the organization of a, you know, when you run for office in the 8th District, or especially on the range, if you're going to run for state representative, I have some experience with these conversations. If you're going to run for state representative on the range, you will be approached by someone, and they'll ask you, you know, a few questions that will, it's like a shadow primary on the issue of mining and where, what side are you on? Right. And it's, that used to be a union question. Now it's a company question.
But I think any nuance is automatically put into a binary conversation.
Yeah.
You know, you either, if you have any nuance, they want to pigeonhole you into one or the other.
Right.
The thing that I find fascinating just it, from the horse race part of this is that I do think Stauber has a very clear path to the nomination, and I think can use the primary season to really shore up his campaign, his get out the vote effort, mm-hmm. his basically build a machine that's going to be good for the general election. And so in a sense, he's got this time to put things together. And I think if this were a race that were going to be decided in the coffee shops and the local radio stations, the community radio stations, and you know, the local newspaper endorsements and all those things, I think Stauber has like going to hit the ground running and has a huge advantage over whoever wins the primary. The sad thing is, and I looked this up as we were talking, the Democrats nationwide need 24 seats to win the House. It's going to be, I don't know how close it's going to be. I've seen things that say, oh, it'll be, they're going to get 40. I've seen other ones saying they're going to be lucky to get 15. There's a lot of ambiguity on that. I think we'll kind of firm up as we get closer. I think what is very clear is that this is one of them that they're counting on retaining. They're not counting on losing this one. And they know it's a battleground. The Republicans, the outside money for Republicans is going to be here in force. The outside money from the Democrats is going to be here in force. And I feel like, to the detriment of us in many ways, the narrative of this election is not going to come from one of the campaigns. It's not going to come from the people in this district and what we want to talk about. It's going to be kind of, in a sense, forced upon us. We're having this conversation now nationwide about Russians interfering with elections, and what should Facebook be allowed to do, and can you post an ad that has a political message or not on Google or what have you. We are going to be inundated, right or wrong, with all kinds of outside interpretations on who we are and what our priorities should be. And at the end of the day, I think that that favors the GOP. And I'll say it because of this. I think a lot of those GOP messages originate from areas that are more like ours than the DFL messages tend to originate. The DFL messages, when they're outside money coming in, tends to be, you know, this person doesn't care about the environment, this person doesn't care about, and it doesn't move people in the same way that the outside spending for GOP ads do. The outside GOP ads say, you know, this person is going to give away the country, or for, you know, immigrants coming in and taking your jobs or what have you. Emotionally, mm-hmm. which is what those ads do, they play to people's emotions and fears. It is a more compelling, if this is just going to be a race of outside money, I feel like the GOP has an advantage there because the message is a more get out the vote kind of message.
Well, emotional arguments need to be simplistic.
Yes.
And this, the Republican argument, certainly Trump's presidency and his mode of operation is very emotional, simple messages repeated.
That's not to say there isn't something very deep there that's being tapped into.
Yeah.
But if we got to put this, I mean, if we got to capture people's attention in 6 weeks with 5 tweets, I can do that, you know, in mm-hmm. I can do that for both parties. I mean, both parties have their tweets. What I'm suggesting is that the DFL tweets tend to originate from people down in the metro area looking up here saying, well, you should care about the environment and you should care about, yeah. you know.
Well, I don't think that's the tack the DFL nominee is going to take race.
I don't think the nominee will take it. What I'm suggesting is that the nominees for both parties are going to be drowned out by outside money. And mm-hmm. I think the outside money, in this case, coming in, the message is more calibrated on the GOP side to the district than what I've seen in the past and what I think you'll get on the DFL side.
I'm seeing two things nationally that play in locally, and one of them is, despite what you hear, I do think there is an increasing sense of organization among the Democratic message around issues like healthcare, and some they're trying to make this a pocketbook election, and they think that economic disparities and the uncertainty over the changes to the healthcare laws, and then the fundamental unfairness of the tax bill are messages that are going to help them. At the same time, we live in the era of Trump. It will be called that in history books. Well, however it turns out, that's what they're going to call this period. And that means that short, staccato tweets from on high get to be bombed in like fireballs into a place like the 8th. We already know the president's coming next week,
right?
June 20th. And by the time you hear this, maybe he's already been here, and God knows what he did when he was here. But we know that he can do that at a moment's notice, and if it's popular, if this goes well, you know, you're going to hear Trump robocalls for Pete Stauber, who has run very closely with Trump. So the other thing I'd argue is that you have some sense of message organization from Democrats, and if that works, great, but they're really just hoping that Trump's approval rating in the 8th District falls below 50%. I think Stauber's take in the 8th District is exactly what Trump's approval rate is. I don't think there's a hair of difference between those two things.
Yeah, and I wouldn't doubt that. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And I think right now it's probably around 50%, maybe better. And therefore, we can say right now, I think Stauber might be ahead. But where this goes and what happens over the summer is, I think, what it is. But if you're a Democrat, that is not an enviable position, because you're stuck watching this, hoping for a wave, hoping that that Trump blows up, or that his approval rating drops.
With Sam potentially nipping from you more than the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.